Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jay Carson. Jay Carson teaches creative writing, literature, and rhetoric at Robert Morris University, where he is professor of communications. He has been writing poetry for several years and has read at venues such as the Mattress Factory and Hemingway's. His work appears or is forthcoming in Paper Street, Confluence, the Yalabusha Review, Eclipse, and the Hawaii Review. Hi, Jay. How are you?
I'm fine, Jan. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you. You're going to read from your manuscript with the interesting and unusual title of Baking the Ginger Boy's Tongue. Okay.
Right. Thanks. This first poem is a poem that takes place in the fall, which is my favorite time here in Pittsburgh. It was published locally, and it deals with something I'm very interested in, which is nature's and our own aging, and how it can be interesting if it's not filled with too much regret. It's one of my few overtly political poems referring to Lyndon Johnson, but in his retirement. I saw a picture one time of him in his retirement, and I was struck with how he looked like what he seemed not to like during his life. Lyndon Johnson's hair. November came down to Pittsburgh, having laid waste the north trees, before leaving them like mousy thrift shop sweaters, shrinking on the stick bones of old tree women. But first October came and set the city afire, as if a maniac god had returned to the steel mills burn everywhere. The aging can only envy those leaves' graceful tragedy of turning without stumble or fearful rant. How can we learn to be fall? Must we all become like Lyndon Johnson's hair, growing ghost of his late hiding, immodestly, uncontrollably bleaching into what he once most feared, shocking Apache of elder statesmen, a whitening length of rebel, hippie, ho, crowns a snowy surrender wave to all the glorious red and yellow, black and white that could yet be. This next poem is about my nickname. I've been called Jaybird a lot of my life by endeared aunts and friends. I still have a relative who calls me Jaybird, and it really used to make me kind of mad until I discovered that Jaybirds are kind of tough. This is a poem that sees Jaybirds as part of memory pretending to be good for me. Jaybird, I'm the blue lightning in the backyard of your mind, shrieking, fighting the sedate warblers, a honking, insistent reminder. I circle low and perch in your neglected backyard. Rusty slides and swings, the red of a first bloody nose, reflected glimpse of white under Amanda's plaid jumper. I am your nail scratching on the faded third-grade blackboard, the flutter of scampered hiding from parents' attacks, the smell print of their hot feet. I am your beautiful cobalt terror. I bolt sometimes to the nearby university buildings and watch alone the dental researcher slip silently into the medical labs to break the doped baboon's teeth with little heavy hammers to make human life better. And this is a poem that is the title of the manuscript. It's throughout my life, I've been impressed with what you could say at certain times and what you couldn't say and how that changed. This takes place in a bakery when I'm 12 years old. Baking the ginger boy's tongue. What do you want? The white uniform voice feeds my anxious sweet hunger, but iced with the fear of women's words. Them, the ones next to, I said. Crumb buns? You want the crumb buns or the flopovers? Which? The old are hungry for words pointing power. But I have heard Bogart, Cooper, and my brother's slang swagger too clearly not to taste the rancid and feminine-scented sweet words. I can't give you any until you say. Her eyes bulge at me like muffins rising in the tin. Finally, timed and done, I rise. Crumbuns, crumbuns, I cry quickly through slitted mouth, cut open for the first of many times by the sweet cinnamon of desire. This also is about what you're allowed to do, this next poem, about what you're allowed to do at certain times in your life. And this is I think it's a stereotype keeps us from doing certain things. It's hard for boys to be allowed, young boys to be allowed to love beauty. This is called Something in the Eye. It takes place, again, in East Liberty, where I spent a lot of my youth at the Woolworths, where I accidentally stumbled into the woman's department one time. Something in the Eye. Always my shining, safe, after-movie place. Woolworths was even more brilliant from the darkness of January's late afternoon snow. Cold-numbed, filmed full eyes, I stumbled into the women's department, rings in their glistening quartz stones as larcenously luminescent and high as my eyes. It stun from the middle of a careless pile like my pretty Aunt Anne amidst her sisters. One shop girl talked to another, her hair alluring gold as the ring setting. Can I help you? I want that ring for my mother. It's too small for your mother. It's a girl's ring. My sister, then. I want that ring. Before I married, my wife talked me out of watching basketball to pick our china. Her plan 3 hours turned into six as I brought plate after lustrous plate for her rejection, until the one I broke and left. It was the day before the last film we saw as single people, the sad one about the Hermitage Museum.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jay Carson. I want to ask you about the interplay of image and statement in your poems. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of stunning images that have a lot of punch and energy, and then you have a statement seemingly coming from out of nowhere, but with a lot of power, such as, I'm the blue lightning in the backyard of your mind. Mm-hmm. I know that's how the Jaybird poem begins, but mm-hmm. Can you talk about that interplay of image and statement?
I'm a big believer that we think initially in terms of pictures. I'll see a picture first, and then I have to try to make sense out of that picture. And the sense is the statement. I look for statements. I try to think that the statements are really the truth, but I think really that it's the image that's really the truth, and we all try to put those images together in some way mm-hmm. that makes sense.
Have you ever written from paintings, for example, or constructed images?
I have done a little bit of that, but I also tend to believe that those things have already had been seen through images and already been translated. But I was just at the Frick Museum yesterday looking at some of those, the power that people get out of short line drawings. It seems unbelievable to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, so if the images have already been rendered from another picture, and you would then work from that, does that make that less? You said, I tend to believe they've already been interpreted or something, so you don't want to do it?
The answer is that it shouldn't, but it does for me.
Okay.
And I don't know why. I wish I had a great answer for that.
Okay. I have a lot to ask you about, but I think poems, we have to hear some poems.
Great. I'm happy to go on. This is another fall poem about the richness of life and its destructive forces. It's called Wounded Year. This fall, the maples bleed into deep November, stain the dun landscape with crimson markers. Raccoons and possums, frantic but clumsy slow, litter the roadside dead. Their arms reach out as if for slipped-away dance partners. I have this photo, a Sicilian wedding sheet, A smeared red flag hung on a Palermo window by some proud couple, reminding me that even the innocent cut the bargain that we will live the life out of each other. I've found that I write a lot of poetry about my childhood, particularly being 10, 11, 12 years old. And as a consequence, I tend to write about my parents. This is a poem about some time I spent with my father and its influence. He seemed always to be trying to civilize me and teach me. I'm a teacher, but he was really, I think, in many ways more a teacher, or at least as much a teacher. In this poem, he's trying to teach me bridge, and I think something like high tea. I was never exactly sure. It's called bridge cheese. My father had his Sunday cheeses, difficult to pronounce and hard to hear, for a 10-year-old, even one learning bridge, the Roquefort and Camembert. The deep, steep tea seemed all grown up, and the pecan sandwiches, squeezed out silky, teasing onion, tangy potato salad oozed mayonnaise in seas. But it was the cheese that was the knife that yerked at my young guts. They all smelled of rotten crumble, the thought of mummies in rut. But old was just the point my young hand didn't comprehend, my father tasting death to finesse it to the end. This is another poem about some time I spent with my father. He was often, I remember him as often reaching out to me, but he was reaching out often in a way that I couldn't take. I wonder sometimes how I ended up as a rhetoric teacher. This helps to explain it, I think. You should probably know, or if you don't, I'm sure you probably do, that the amplified style was Cicero's chosen compromise style. It's called Rainy Day Rhetoric. Dark sheets of rain hiss down Kentucky Avenue. Cicero, sunny Cicero, my father will read from a splitting leather volume. Him to me to lighten today. Recto verso, Latin, English, transliteration over darkening sherry. I cannot understand how to listen to the rain killing me in the amplified style. More contemporary, I ended up in the hospital on Super Bowl Sunday with chest pains. This was before halftime, so I can't blame it on Janet Jackson. Everything turned out to be okay. But I was wondering, as I was sitting there going through all these tests, what it is that could cause my heart pain, anybody's heart pain. And it occurred to me that they're the same things that can also cause poems. The poem starts with a doctor who's trying to get me to face what might be the truth while I'm coming up with all sorts of excuses of why I'm just fine. It's called Chest Pains. Well, something happened. The stern doctor rudely cut my syrupy stream of how the creases and pricks must have come from the suggestion of a movie, my friend's triple bypass, or perhaps sleeping wrong. Yes, sleeping wrong, where I feel pressings, kneadings, and hear old footfalls. Is it the touch of my 4-year-old son's lips for taking only one from 5,000 day benders of work for him? Or the rib-rattle echo of clicking heels, high-arched, tailored brunette walking against my one-way street? My nocturnal chest creases in recoil at my last wife's blonde zinc taste. And the dreams of day, my brother's voice urging abandon, all the fighting, leaping, tackling, exhausted race. Or is it the pain the inner pictures show, spreading like oily film, the worn wall of every childish dream bouncing back? On a summer Sunday, I stay after benediction to see the soft light of a cathedral rose window. Saints and crucifix in endless leaded sky made of a thousand shards. People have asked me where I get ideas for poems, and I was delighted to hear from somebody who ran a workshop one time that taking a walk is a work for a poet. I thought, that's what I want to do. I often get ideas taking walks, sitting, staring, or this is actually from lying in a steam room after working out. It's called Locker Room Maskarovka. Maskarovka is a term from the Soviet military, meaning deception, misleading the enemy in some way or another. We are showering and dressing after workouts, some fast, others meandering, drying bent over or hiking legs up to benches, dish rag toweling or with soft post-op pat-pats, even blow dryers, soft, insistent electric attention. We show our best body, a bravado of staunched leaks that might spill more of us than all our talk of golf and women and winning. The flouters, the hiders, the modest, the open, the cruel bodies, the kind, the hairy backs, cold, white, caving chests, classic David penises, others rolling off old bodies as if only a thick, loose thread. All as our mothers taught us to embrace looks and care from others, ourselves. I hide in a locker and wait for a young, damp, bathed boy and the soft technique of his dam.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jay Carson. Reading from his manuscript entitled Baking the Ginger Boy's Tongue. There's some kind of feeling in a lot of your poems, and also you did mention it a couple times, what we're allowed to do in this culture, I guess you mean, or what we're allowed to say, what we're not allowed to say as children. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how much of a driving force that is for your poetry?
I often think of my father told me a story one time that he was traveling abroad and he bought me a tie in London, and the salesperson asked him what kind of person I was, and my father said, I think he pretends to be straight-laced, but he is not. And I always kind of liked that. I think I was raised in a very sort of straight-laced environment. I wanted to produce what I was supposed to produce. I originally set out to be a lawyer because that's what my father was and that's what was expected. But I found increasing displeasure with that and really increasing joy in trying to find out who I am. So I think those things are so important to find out who you are and what you do well. But I think it's so hard. Mm-hmm. Has been for me anyway.
Mm-hmm. And how does that inform your poetry?
I think a poetry is problem-solving for me. It's sort of what's out in the world that doesn't match my image of the way it should be. Or sometimes it's the way I have to change my image to match what's out there. Mm-hmm. Or I have to change my image to what's really my image. I'm sometimes working off of your image or somebody else's image.
Well, this is all interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm still back on the image in the painting that you don't want to interpret because someone else has already done that. And as related to how off every time, at least today when you read your poetry, you illuminate your work in a way by telling us the link to your life, you know. Mm-hmm. This relates to this, this relates to this. And I'm just thinking of the idea of replication and interpretation. And it seems that's all through what we're talking about and all mm-hmm. through your poetry. Yeah. So, but and I still want to ask you the question you say you don't have an answer to, but how I'll ask it. How... How can it be less if you further comment on something that someone else has already commented on, as in a painting? Or what do you lose when you do that?
I'm a bad models person. When I teach, my students sometimes complain that I don't give them enough models, and that's because I don't work off of models. I think I should, but there's this rebellious streak. You know, it's the tie on the next rack or whatever that makes me want to do something different, and I'm afraid I'll be overly influenced, I think.
Okay. You have a disdain for models.
I don't know if it's a disdain. I think it's more a fear.
This is very interesting. Okay.
That the model will take me over.
Okay. But then the work of other poets, I'm sure you read a lot of poets to work from, to learn from.
Yes, but I don't talk about it.
Okay. Okay, let's have more poems. More poems.
Thank you. This is another childhood poem. The only thing, I think it's pretty self-explanatory, it takes place in my playground when I was in grade school, the Sacred Heart Playground, which is a street. The only thing you have to know about it is Buck Buck is a savage schoolyard game called Last in the Playground. I'm the last one in the Sacred Heart Playground, surviving Buck Buck more than I survived later, lonelier games. All playmates called home now to big kids' schools, jobs, now to important titles and suits that prove that many and mom still love them. I walk the street valley between the grade and high school, in between work and lunch, tag and toothless, cement empty of playmates. Here come some, thank God, so to speak, in their plaid skirts and Catholic knots. Relentless teachers counting out, silence, even if your partner is making a fool of themselves. Good advice for divorce courts. But how can you play Buck Buck and not make a fool? How can you be 11? This is a poem sort of at the other end of the emotional line for me. I rarely get poems out of dreams. This is one of the few that I did. It's called Death Guard. Darkening in the evening half-light, brothers and friends convince me to enter a casket while alive, to be buried for only a little while. I will be safe, they assure me, because of the dog at my feet who will bark to warn them where to come and dig me up fine. But why must I half die anyway? And what if the dog attacks me? I ask for time to think. They are silver statues staring at the moon. Don't disappoint us. We're counting on you. The dog is in a sack. Don't be afraid. It's all in your mind to worry. I think of running away and wonder where I could go to find a way from these, my people, who know all my secret wishes. This is a poem that I got after reading a story about a sex addict. It's placed in Times Square, but of course Times Square is far different now than it was years ago. I went to school outside New York, and it was really something in those days. It's called Peep Show, an addict song. Well-hung neon wall tubes, embarrassed red, withered yellow, call out live nude models as if we wouldn't look at a dead one. In childhood, I hoped for kitchen sweetness, expecting always, even alone, the peach pie, despite these dirty hand surety, a filthy biscuit bite. I have cooked up and spit out tales of the sweetness of tasted peaches, telling of the grab and circumference of bouncy, cheesy rounds, bought, watched, and held down below me, but that I could no more have than the ineffable, crumbling crust, infinity of a loving baker's touch, that I search for in every shop. In this salmon light I run out of time. Models change 5 times daily, to scour off my pressure cooking gaze. And this is a poem about a rat. I think it's pretty self-explanatory, except near the end where it refers to the Irish wake. I was told that the Irish wake was really originally a way of creating a lot of sound and dancing to keep out the vermin. The rat. I thought I had felt everything. The Cartagena women teaching me their scarf and sofa dance. The night 100 crows flew low above my house. The hot breath of their wings in my hair. Knees guiding the sliding Palomino killer down the rocky dunes. But nothing touched me like the rat, scampering down my arm from the garbage lid, skipping, now thrown from my aorta, to elbow, to flinging arm, to driveway edge, down its length to a neighbor's rock hole. I watched it go slow after the circus ride on two pink me. Logie from eating through a heavy blue plate of plastic trash can bottom, half a brown bag of black peeled rind, and now swaying chicken guts. Ah, to love everything, from the fallen owl to the dead cat, to the moment between the courses of the midnight repast, when my poor Irish ancestors collapsed exhausted from their wake dance and the next day's almost full burial. This is a poem about a recommitment to poetry. It takes place at an artist colony just outside Uniontown. It's called How I Would Become a Blacksmith. The artist colony is a stone's throw over the mountain, a skip from the summit. Children as old as me laugh and do art as pretty as the orchids at Kentuck Knob, a T-square diagonal and hard number 2 pencil line across Route 40. Inside the gift cottage, an eternal blacksmith looks through my eyes, slow, deep, insistent. We have a visiting artist, he says, who made an ornate bone saw based on old medical books. It cuts through metal or anything. My wife has a spa appointment, I say. I'll come back and see your forge tomorrow. His eyes saw through my wire of words into marrow. The maker will be gone then. So I go and hear of burning plans for the hardest things. Banked fires in my mind's back furnace smolder, remind me of words unwrought, songs unsung, stories unsaid, unseen, undone. The ancient artist has shown me his own forge, an open hearth to fire my promise. To return as a student apprentice, to learn, to build again. You will take home something you have made. Everybody does. His eyes see my lock, tumblers akimbo, waiting for the combination of commitment. I tell of my metal maker to an artist friend with a wise and definite touch, how the ironbender's words still bolt in my mind as limbo's gates cast before or after me. When I was there, she said, he was the alabaster man.
The poetry of Jay Carson. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Great work. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Sound engineers are Joel Grimes and Joseph Wilk. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, radio made possible with member support, 91.3 WYEP.